Thanks so much for joining us on WPR. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about life on the Driftless area of Wisconsin to begin the show. And our guest, Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. If you live in the Driftless area, tell us what's been happening around your neck of the woods. Tell us why you love Lake Onalaska. Or join in with your questions about anything going on in that Driftless area and along the Mississippi. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Reggie McLeod, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks, Larry.
Well, you wrote about some changes coming to Big River Magazine, and that was kind of fascinating to me because I didn't really know the history of the magazine. Maybe you could give us a little brief history of your magazine and tell us what's new.
Sure. Well, we started in 1993. That was the first issue, and it was a big year. A lot of changes on the river that year. But we've been plugging away since then, and at this point, I am just turned 74, so I need to slow down a little bit here. And there's a new model for a lot of the media that, of course, the public radio has been using for a long time, is nonprofit, and there's a lot of really good publications and operations that are nonprofit. Right now, like the Guardian newspaper is a nonprofit. Harper's Magazine has been a nonprofit for, I think, over 100 years. And, of course, public radio. And we're converting Big River into a nonprofit publication. We've been paying the bills and making payroll and all of that just fine. But I think for the future, it's probably a good idea. And we can use some grants then to expand some of our offerings. We want to do more online. We'd like to post all 31 years of back issues online so people can use those for resources and search them. A lot of the stories are about animals and environmental changes and communities. And some of them are history stories now because they're, 30 years old. So there's a lot of cool things that we want to do in the near future, and in the process of converting to a nonprofit. We have an excellent board of directors. We have a nonprofit already in place, and we have been just started to get contributions the last few weeks.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And they're really, the tenor of the magazine doesn't seem to be changing. You may be just adding some things.
Yeah, we're going to keep the same crew. I'm going to keep working on it as long as I can. And we're going to have the same office and all the same gear and everything. But we have a good, really experienced board of directors that's going to help us with the conversion and kind of keep it on a steady course. One of the guys on our board of directors, I stumbled across our first subscriber list, which was very short. And he was on that list 31 years ago. He's been reading Big River since the first issue, and he's worked in a number of he started nonprofits. He gave out grants from the McKnight Foundation for years. And so anyway, we're going to be pretty much the same, but hopefully a little better, and maybe we'll reach a wider audience by having better online presence and an improved online version of the magazine too. But we're going to stay in print. We love print, and
so do I.
yeah, I do too. In fact, when I find a good story I want to read online, I usually print it out and come back and read it.
Well, one section I really enjoy, and by the way, Clara Neipert has said this too, our producer, that how much she enjoys just reading the whole news of the whole magazine, and I do as well. One of the first areas that I always go to is the some river news of interest, and The Upper Mississippi River Basin Association released a water quality report on the river from, I think it was from Minnesota to Missouri, and list contaminants, some that are up and some that are down.
Yeah, they used to cruise up here every few years and do that report. But now they have a different method for doing it. But yeah, the big problem has been, and all along really, is silt, most of which comes from, not directly from farmland, but because of drainage tiles in farmland that makes the water, gets the water into the rivers faster rather than letting it get into the groundwater. And nitrates. Nitrates are a big problem, and they're a big problem even in a lot of the groundwater in our area now. And phosphorus is getting a little better, and in some places nitrates, you know, have slowed down, but generally they've been increasing in the water.
Yeah, I saw chloride levels were up quite 30% or something from 50 years or so.
Yeah, that's the salt. That's when you're walking down the sidewalk, and that's not snow you're shuffling through. That's salt. That's not good for the water. That's really rough on the lakes too. It's a big problem in lakes because they don't have the flow that the river has. But yeah, I have a friend that went around town here, and we've hardly gotten any snow this winter. And he shoveled up several pounds of salt really easily. He just ran. He's a biology professor, and he ran around with a shovel, and it's just amazing. And there was no snow. People just automatically throw out pounds and pounds of salt, and that's a big problem.
We looked. You looked at flood restoration and prevention projects in our state. Are probably going to get some money here. Tell us about that bill that Governor Evers, I think, has he signed it yet?
I don't know.
I don't think he's signed it yet, but it's a bill to allow grants relating to floods and prevention projects.
Yeah, a lot of it is because of climate change now, because a lot of, and I ask an engineer with the federal government, I won't say who it was. A few years ago, I was doing a story on climate change, and this was in after 2019, when we had a record amount of rain going down the Mississippi River. It was 32% more water in the course of a year than the previous record, and many places in Wisconsin and Minnesota recorded record amounts of rain. And I said, when they build things, when they build dikes and roads and install culverts and that, they look at tables that tell you what the 500-year flood is and the 100-year flood and so on, and they design things so that they will survive normal and somewhat extreme weather. And we were talking about that, and I said, well, with this new record rainfall, all our infrastructure is out of spec now. And he paused for a long time. And he said, well, the specifications are different now than they used to be. And that kind of summed it up. I mean, so there's a lot of work to be done. And there's a lot of work that has been done. I know along the river they've install bigger culverts all along the river roads, and they've replaced a lot of, even the small bridges over trout streams and such have been, you know, raised a little bit, and they make them a little wider and things like that. So, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done for flood resilience.
Let's talk about birds for a minute. There's an interesting tidbit of news in your magazine about some high-tech binoculars, and bird watchers might be excited about this new product.
Yeah, they can. They don't have to put down their binoculars to take pictures now, and they, you know, it's computerized binoculars basically. So they can get really good resolution and record what they're looking at without taking those binoculars away from their eyes. It's
kind of amazing. And it'll tell you the species.
Yeah. Oh, right. That's right. I'd forgotten about that. It's just like, I know, I've been hiking with people a lot the last few years when you say, what is that plant? And they whip their phone out and take a picture of it. And a few seconds later, they tell you what it is. And you'll be able to do that with these binoculars, too. And I'm sure you can record the time and place, too, so you can prove it to your friends when you've seen some rare bird or some bird that's not normally around here.
Well, I want to switch to features for a minute because the beloved, and I would say it's beloved, Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife Refuge has suffered from budget cuts, and as a result, staff numbers are down. Why has the refuge seen this decrease in funding, do you think?
Well, you'd have to ask Congress
about
that. They and it's been a steady decline for quite a while now. And in the story, they go back quite a few years. And in 2013, it was $4,400,000 and change. And last year, it was $3,400,000 and change. So it's a little more than $1 million less than it was 10 years before that in 2013. So, and that's, you know, if you put inflation in there, those years when we had, you know, 5-6% inflation, they're really hurting. And there are empty desks, and there are a lot of positions on the refuge that are unfilled, including the game. They don't call them game wardens, but that's what they are essentially. I think there's only one for the whole 261 miles of river that's in the refuge. And ironically, this year in June will mark the 100th anniversary of the refuge. So What a way to celebrate!
Yeah,
they're really struggling, and in fact, the refuge manager for the whole refuge is also managing. I forget how many refuges they have her managing from Winona, and these are refuges all over the country. And the last time I talked to her, she didn't even have an assistant refuge manager, which has always been a position that was filled. So it's really a shame because this is an incredible resource. I mean, 261 miles of the Mississippi here is a refuge, and Wisconsin really has the largest share of that shoreline. That goes from the bottom of Lake Pepin all the way down into Illinois.
Might be something worth talking to our representatives about.
Well, that's where the problem is. You know, they decide where the money goes, and it's not going for this refuge. And getting back to climate change, you know, and invasive species are a huge problem on the refuge. But of course, climate change affects everything on the river as well.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, our guest today. Questions or comments for him? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer, our technical director, A. Emily Ralph. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Questions for him, or comments, maybe an experience to share, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Reggie, just back to the Upper Mississippi Refuge for a second. Volunteers are stepping up to help, but, you know, they can only go so far. But what about that part of it?
There are some really active friends groups, and they're not it varies over the length of the refuge. Actually, the most active group, and this is kind of amazing, is the Friends of Pool 9. And Pool 9 is the area between La Crosse down to around Ferryville, almost to Prairie du Chien. And I think the largest city on that stretch is Lansing, Iowa. And I don't think they have 1,000 people in Lansing. And they have over 800 members of the Friends of Pool 9, which is unbelievable. These guys do an unbelievable job, and they get out and do river cleanups, and they help repair things on the refuge, and they really lend a hand to the fish and wildlife people. And there's a hatchery in Genoa, Wisconsin, which is on Pool 9, just south of Genoa. It's part of the Fish and Wildlife Service too, and there's a lot of volunteers that help out over there because the whole Fish and Wildlife Service is kind of on hard times now. But other stretches of the river, you get below Pool 9, and there's no Friends group that I'm aware of until you get down around Savannah, Illinois. So there's a big stretch in there where they don't get that kind of help. So it varies, and it's impressive where it works, but yeah, there's a lot of places where they just don't have any or have very few volunteers working now.
Steve in Duluth, Minnesota, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling, Steve.
Hey, Larry, thanks a lot. Hey, Reggie, Steve Tomford here. I just wanted to shout out to you that, you know, just really, you've done a wonderful job with this magazine. I was excited in the recent issue to see the big changes for Big River, and it sounds great. I think the going nonprofit will really help you expand. I read your magazine comes. I read it from cover to cover over a week. I got a sample for my mom and dad and some bro to Minnesota this year, and I just love it. And it's a wonderful format. I'm just saying thanks, Reggie, for the work you've done. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Very, very nice to hear. Steve, thank you very much for calling. And you can join in 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Kind of a fun story about the SAP run. When the SAP started running early, we had an entire community step in to help the harvest at the Prairie Island Park.
Yeah, that was kind of unusual. Well, you know, everything has been a month early this year. Even maybe we're getting our April blizzard a month early here. But the SAP started running a month early in late January. And usually it's late in February or early March when they start tapping the trees. So there's a campground in Winona, Minnesota on Prairie Island on the river there. And the couple that runs this campground, it's owned by the city, they have a lot of events there, and they involve community members and gardening and so on. And when this sap started flowing, they rounded up a bunch of volunteers. Here are the volunteers again. And they were harvesting sap and cooking it down, and they pulled everything together really quickly. It was pretty impressive. And then they divide up the sap among the workers, so everyone gets some maple syrup at the end of the process. And a lot of kids and families were involved in that. It's pretty cool.
And some nice photos to go along with it. I liked that story. Well, Minnesota recently released a new plan for controlling the spread of invasive carp. Well, we got four species of carp that they're zeroing in on, I think. What ideas do officials have to prevent carp from getting upriver?
Well, for years now, they've been trying to work on this. And the carp, especially the silver carp, are the big problems. Those are the jumping ones you've seen in videos on YouTube and so on. And they have found them all the way up to the Twin Cities in the St. Croix. But there are not a lot of them. And they're not reproducing up in the Wisconsin stretch of the river. They might be a little bit in the southern part. But they can't really block them because they're already up here. They're trying to manage them, basically.
Yeah.
And it seems a little goofy, and I'm not going to be judgmental, but they're trying to stop them with sounds and flashing lights and so on in the lock. So it's not easy for them to get through the dams. They have to actually, the dams on the Mississippi have gates that come down from the top. So the water is still flowing underneath the gates, but it's flowing under such pressure, usually, that the fish can't swim through those gates, except in the spring they take the gates all the way out when the water's real high, and then it's pretty easy to swim up there. But this plan is focused on the locks, because when the locks open to let boats and towboats through, the carp do swim through the locks, and they put radio transmitters on a lot of them so they can kind of keep track of them. And they have definitely proved that they lock through on the locks. So they're trying to install these barriers in the locks that will use light and sound, and they've tuned them. They've studied the silver carp and the others, so they have a sound that repels them. And they've been experimenting for a couple of years now. They've actually had carp roundups where they control the carp with these sounds, and they get them, confine them to a small area, and commercial fishermen come in and net them and pull them out of the river. So they're looking at Lock and Dam 5, which is upriver of Fountain City. It's near Buffalo City, Wisconsin. And that's a good one because it doesn't have a standard spillway. Spillways on the river are often underwater during the flood, so fish could swim up there. But at 5, they have pipes that come out of the river that act as spillways, and the fish would actually have to jump up in the air into a pipe to get through there. So if they can block them at the lock and dam, that'll be an effective barrier. Those of us who live downriver of that lock and dam, including La Crosse and Prairie du Chien, we'll have the carp confined to that area, and that's one of the problems that some people see with this plan. But it's a good place to test this technique, and if they get enough money, they might even install them on the dam itself. So they're having a series of meetings this winter about the new Minnesota plan. Now, Minnesota is the only state that's really focusing on this, and Wisconsin hasn't joined in on this, and neither has Iowa or Illinois. And but Minnesota's going ahead with this, and they're trying to raise the money to put this barrier on 5 and see how it works. Now, there's a similar barrier that they've had on the lock down on Lock and Dam 19 in Grafton. And that's a lock and dam that's really high. It's like your standard dam. It doesn't have gates that push in the water. It has a wall, and they generate electricity there. So there's really no way for the carp to get through that lock and dam except through the lock. So they've had an experimental version of this on the lock, and it's stopped a lot of carp, but I think it's not much more than 50% effective right now. They also have barriers on the Illinois River on the locks and dams, and they are electrical. Very high voltage and very expensive to build and operate, and somewhat dangerous. You know, I mean, they have to be able to repel the fish in the water. They haven't been talking about putting those on the Mississippi River, but those are there to keep carp out of the Great Lakes, to keep the silver carp and the other three species out of the Great Lakes. And so far, they seem to be working.
Yeah, and Illinois spent a bunch of money, over $10 million.
Oh, yeah, they're enormously expensive, and they've rebuilt them a few times, and it's it's like a battle. But on the river, they're already here, but they're managing them. They don't want them to start reproducing. And when the population density, Now, this, I don't know that this has been proved, but a lot of experts believe that when the population density reaches a certain point, they'll start reproducing. But they don't until they get, you know, a big crowd of carp together, and then they do.
Go at it. Okay.
Yes. They spawn. Yes.
Oh, man. Natalie in Menominee, Michigan has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if the Big River guy knows much about the proposed sulfide mine on the Menominee River, which borders northeast Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
Well, I do, and I keep track of a lot of those things, but we don't normally put them in Big River because we're trying to maintain our regional focus. But yeah, I've been keeping an eye on the mining up there and, of course, near the boundary waters, too. And I'm concerned, but we don't write about it. It doesn't mean that we don't care about it. The mining in the Driftless area that's caused a lot of concern has been for frac sand for a few years, and that's still going on. The sulfide mining is an interesting situation, and I think the concern is probably warranted. They don't have a great track record for containing damage and that sort of thing, and I think that's what where a lot of the opposition comes from.
Yeah. Natalie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. There is a great feature written by, I think Joanne Funk wrote it, in this issue. It's about the creation of Lake Onalaska, which began in 1935.
Yeah. that's a story that I've been thinking about since before I started Big River Magazine, because I had talked a few times to people whose family had farms on the land that is now Lake Onalaska. And there was a community there, and the lock and dam, and they built the lock and dam system in the 30s. And this system that was built in the 30s was to create a 9-foot channel for shipping. And that involved a lot of big dams. I mean, they were huge public works. And the one in, it's just north of La Crosse, upstream of La Crosse, they built a dam across to French Island, and that created a 7,000-acre lake. I mean, it's a huge lake with islands and so on. And I always thought that would be a great story, but I never got around to it. And Joanne grew up right on that lake, and grew up, you know, as a river rat, hunting and fishing and boating on that lake. And I was talking to her about it, and she kind of jumped at the chance to do it. She liked the idea, and I thought she's a perfect person to do it. And her father was a pretty well-known environmentalists that did a lot of work on protecting the lake and restoring habitat on the lake and so on. He actually has a boat landing named after him, Fred Funk. So Joanne did a great job on this. I'm really glad that I waited and that she got to do it, because she really tore into it.
It's a fascinating story about, you know, some people lost a lot, but then there were others who came out of it pretty good. One fellow bought up a bunch of the land.
Yeah, and that's land near where Joanne grew up. And there's a very popular restaurant there, Red Pine Supper Club, right on there. Some guys really just were thinking ahead. They looked at the elevation and they thought, well, the new shoreline is going to be here. And this is going to be dry land right next to it. I better buy it and put some cottages on it. And that was showing some quick thinking.
Yeah,
and
but in the meantime, a lot of farms went away, and even the trees, they cut down the trees, didn't they?
Yeah, you know, in the old river maps, and I mean like 20 or 30 years ago, all the river maps would mark out stump fields. So when they built the locks and dams, they had to flood a lot of forest land. So they paid people to go out and cut all the trees to log it off, and they left, you know, stumps that were a few feet high, and sometimes when that land flooded, the water was only a foot or so higher than those stumps. So if you were out there with a boat with a propeller on it, you had to be aware of where those stump fields were, because they would, you know, bust your propeller or break the pin that held it in place pretty easily. I mean, it was a big deal. And now all those have pretty much rotted and disappeared. But I remember maybe 20 years ago I was out volunteering. We were rescuing mussels that were endangered because the river level had been drawn down for some environmental benefits south of La Crosse. And people were cruising around in their boats with those stump fields. And they'd hit those stumps then, and they were rotten enough that they'd just get, you know, you'd hear a sound and you'd be a big chunk of rotten wood would float up. But they were still there, but they're pretty much gone now. But for decades, they were a big deal.
Yeah, a lot of sheared pins.
Yeah.
When that was still an issue. Well, I wanted to mention the story. There's so many stories. We're not touching on all of them by any means, but the Mississippi tow and river boats, really fun article about the names of those boats. Jean Pedig, I think it is, wrote about her hobby of towboat watching. And that seems to be a big deal along the Mississippi.
Yeah, we kind of got this started years ago. We got a printout of all the boats that had locked through one of the locks. I think it was the lock at Trempealeau, Wisconsin. And the names were fascinating, and I actually thought about writing my great American novel, which I keep putting off. I was going to use all the names of towboats on there for characters, but because some of them were really fascinating names. But we, because of that list and talking about this, we did little tow watchers guides, which are kind of like bird watching guides. And we did those every few years. We've done six different editions, and we were going to do one this spring, which we postponed till next year. But we listed all the boats that had come up on this part of the river recently. And some people, including the author, Gene, is one of the people that use these as a towboat watcher. And some people really get into it. I had a friend that had a place in Wabasha, Minnesota, and he said his wife would wake up out of a sound sleep in the middle of the night when she heard a towboat on the river, and she would run out to the window and grab her little tow watcher's guide and the binoculars and spot that. And then there's room where you can write down the date that you saw the boat and the place, and she'd do that at night. And so Jean was intrigued by the names, and a lot of the names are just named after captains or the family in the towboat company. You know, they often, you know, name the boats after the people. But there are also some interesting names like, you know, Tiger and Cooperative Venture, and a lot of them are pretty names like Crimson Glory, Ruby Bell.
Then you've got Ugg the Tug.
Ugg the Tug, yeah, that's up in St. Paul. I'm familiar with that one. Yeah, and then the American Cruise Lines, that's one of the big cruise boat lines, has been naming its boat after musical terms, American Harmony, American Melody, American Symphony, and so on. And then there was the Queens, the Delta Queen Steamboat Company that just went out of business. But I think all of their boats were Queens.
Yeah. Again, Cowboy Carl, Little Charlie, River Matt, Rat.
Yeah, Little Charlie is down at Cassville. And the White Angel is one of the harbor boats at Winona. So it's a fun story. I never thought of that. I think she's a retired academic, and she kind of categorized them, you know.
You have to do that. It's pretty fun. Jeff and Barry Mills, by the way, called. He couldn't stay with us, but he's wondering about the future dredging project on Lake Onalaska. When are they going to dredge, and how much? Do you know?
Well, they're trying to raise money for it now, and one of the results of the lock and dam system is those dams hold back sediment, and a lot of the backwaters get filled in and have to be dredged out periodically, and a lot of them don't get dredged out, so we kind of lose river because of that. But last I heard about Lake Onalaska, they were trying to raise the funds to dredge that out and fix some of the areas that had silted in. And they've done that a couple times in Lake Onalaska, actually. It was Joanne Funk's father that helped, I think, get the first big project in there that built some islands and dredged some new channels. The fish, in order to survive the winter, they need a place that's deep enough that they can survive. And it has to be deep enough because there has to be enough oxygen down there, and the temperature has to be, you know, warm enough and so on. And as the river fills in, those lakes and holes fill in, and that really makes it a lot harder for the fish to survive in the winter. Now, the winter, this winter wouldn't have been much of a problem.
No.
And that's going to give a big boost to the fish, but some winters are pretty tough, and there's a lot of fish kills and so on.
Well, Reggie, we didn't cover half of what you've got in this March-April edition of Big River, but it's always fun to talk with you, and I hope we can do this again next time an issue comes out.
Yeah. Oh, I look forward to it. The next issue is all about the refuge, Larry. We've been doing a lot of extra work. This is going to be a big one. It's 100 years of history and looking to the future and all of that.
Oh, it's going to be fun. Thank you, Reggie. Yeah.
Thank you, Larry.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And, you know, if you want to subscribe or whatever, I think you can go online, you type in Big River Magazine, and you're going to get all the information you need to do that. And you should take a look at it if you haven't already. Well, the weather guys must be the last Monday of the month, because the weather guys are out by A. Emily Ralph in the technical director studio, and they're chomping at the bit to get in and talk with you about climate and weather. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. We got guys with the answers here for sure. It's a weather and climate update. Larry Mueller here for WPR. Steve Ackerman, one of our guests for the rest of the show. He's the former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back.
Yeah, it's great to be here again. Very happy for the last Monday of each month.
And John Martin with us as well, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
As we talk with these two guys, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about how meteorologists forecast visibility? That's something that comes up as we were just talking about the tugboats on the Mississippi River. You're wondering how hot this summer is going to be? I think it's going to be warmer. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, last week, Tuesday, I think, was the vernal equinox, was it not?
Yeah, 10:06 p.m. Tuesday night. Yeah.
They call that the start of spring.
Yeah.
The astronomical start of spring.
Yeah,
for weather people, mm-hmm. it starts in March.
And we all saw, too, didn't we, that the first day of spring is one thing. The first spring day is quite another.
Well, well, I wonder first, why do forecasters differ from the equinox?
I think it's the weather. We typically, you know, break it up into seasons, and so it's a lot easier to pick 3 months, even months. So, you know, winter's December, January, February, and then spring is March, April, and May.
Yeah.
And today we're getting, in the northern part of the state, we're getting 8 to 10 inches of snow, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
while it's
pretty
raining.
Intense event. And and it's hardly raining here anymore. Even it's pretty much seems like it's kind of quit, not so quitting up north.
I brought my umbrella just in case.
Oh, did you?
Nothing worse than a weather guy in the rain without an umbrella.
Well, you know, this time of the year is always seems to be known for dramatic weather. This year, you know, we had 70-degree days in southern Wisconsin. Then last week we had a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. What causes the big temperature swings?
I think this is a very interesting time of year, as you say. It's one where we still have the winter residing really close to us, so that if there is not an excursion of warm, moist air from the south, which can happen increasingly as you get toward the equinox and past it, if we don't have one of them, then winter is kind of hovering over us. But as soon as something well-developed gets itself embedded in the central part of the United States, we can get strong southerly winds ahead of that storm and make us really, really warm. And so we have both, you know, the warmth isn't extreme. The cold still feels extreme. And so, but the contrast between the two, because the zone of contrast is so proximate to us, is always there in March, more than it is in February. You don't get warm. In January, you don't get warm. But in March, you can get warm or cold. It's really interesting.
And it's that contrast that really generates that nasty weather.
Exactly.
The high winds.
Although I think we got warm in February.
We did. This year was just this year was weird across the board, as we all know. Almost 10 degrees above normal every day. I think it was 7.8 degrees above normal for the 90 days from December 1 to February 28th.
Yeah. And we had our first tornado in February
as
well.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I wasn't able to, but a lot of my golfing friends got out to say they could play golf in Wisconsin in February.
Yeah, unreal, isn't it? Just unreal.
March... They always say, what does it go, if it comes in like a lion.
Line out like a lamb.
Hmm. Yeah, out like a lamb. Is there any truth to that at all?
I think it mostly just highlights what you were just talking about, is that it's really the transition month from the cold season to the beginning of the warm season, and it comes in spurts, and it staggers towards the exit because it doesn't know when the winter is really over.
Yeah.
And this has been just the opposite. It came in like a lamb, and it's rather lion-like on the way out, depending on exactly where you are in the state.
Yeah,
and I think these are, Ann Pryor, my wife, was the state folklorist, and so we've looked at this in terms of weather lore, and I think this is one of those situations that really demonstrates weather is really important to our lives, and always has been.
Yeah.
So before we really learned anything about numerical forecasting or physically understanding how the weather works, you know, these nice sayings have developed that... kind of represent people's observations. And some of them were good. Red Sky at Night, Sailor's Delight has some physics in it. Others, in terms of the woolly bear, makes you really wonder about how those things came up. Because there's no connection.
Right. Especially with human attention spans, what they are. You know, how did someone see something in October and remember in March what they saw? I don't think so. But, you know, we're talking about a subject that a colleague of mine and I just had a proposal rejected for the time being at the National Science Foundation. But it's studying the interannual, that is year-to-year variability of the winter to spring transition. And we got some nice comments in the reviews, even though they rejected it. They said this is a long understudied problem and things like that. So it's everybody has it on their mind, whether in the popular culture or in the science itself, but we haven't really dedicated much time to it in the science. So hopefully we'll get a better result on a second submission.
And you can join, if you'd like to submit a question, you can do that right now. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. springtime, is it the windiest season? Or it feels like
I think typically throughout the U.S. it's the windiest month.
Probably a good guess. Yeah, I would think so.
And again, it's back to that contrast between the warm and the cold air.
Yeah.
It's going to generate pressure gradients and generate wind.
Well, and spring is the time for flooding, and NOAA released its report. We're not going to get, probably not going to get much flooding here in Wisconsin.
Well, there was no snow. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The whole upper Midwest, western Great Lakes states had the warmest winter in 132 years. And part of that complexion was a lack of snow. And that's what causes, you know, the flooding of the Red River of the north and places like that, the upper Mississippi. There's just no snow to drain in this year. And plus, it was warm all winter, so anything that fell melted right away. So
and this spring, they're not looking at a lot of precipitation either up in the north.
Yeah. No, they are in the south.
In the southeast. I think they're more like southeast is more like closer to normal. Mm.
Well, it's they're looking. I think NOAA said they were going to. There was more chances for extreme rain, extreme flooding,
in the southeast.
In the southeast. Yeah. Mm. And we're not going to get that.
Yeah,
I mean, we're still in drought
conditions throughout most of the state.
Upper two-thirds at least are in drought conditions for sure. Well, you did speak about your predictions, I think, in your Wisconsin State Journal piece about this summer's weather. What do you see coming in the months ahead?
So it's a tough one because we're in this now transition between El Nino and La Nina. Mm. So we're in this what they call neutral state between those. I don't think it would be too risky to say we're going to be warmer than normal just because climate change is leading to warmer temperatures.
I think we're in the 60-70% chance of that too. I think if I saw the most recent April, May, June forecast from the Climate Prediction Center, I had a 60-ish or percent or higher than equal chances for warmer.
Yeah.
And I think about equal chances for wetter. So maybe nothing unusual in the rain, but a little warmer. And those two kind of go in hand. If that continues to go in that direction, if you stay dry, it's easier to be warmer in July, August, and September if you've had a dry ground all winter, summer long, because it's just easier for the ground to absorb radiation without the water on it. So.
Yeah.
Richard called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering how the coming eclipse will affect the weather, if it has an effect on the weather, and if it's okay to look at the actual total eclipse without...
No. For that last question, the answer is definitely no. I know it's very exciting. The first solar eclipse that I saw back in 79, we didn't have those glasses. And so it was very tempting to do that, but you really should get the glasses. And those glasses are always around now, so it's really not hard to get.
But what about the weather? Is it going to affect the weather?
It doesn't affect the weather. I mean, it's too short. It's like a cloud going by. It doesn't stay around that long. So
I think the other side of the coin is the one you have to worry about. How will the weather affect it? You know, and if you go to a place and you spend a couple of years planning for it, it's cloudy. I think I might still be cool to see it be pretty much dark at midday, even if it is cloudy, but it wouldn't be the same, I would imagine.
Yeah, like I said, I've seen two of them, both of them in open areas, Wyoming, and the other one in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And to watch the zone of darkness coming at you is just phenomenal.
Yeah,
so if it's cloudy, which we're trying to go see it again this year, and we'll see.
Well, you know, was it National Geographic or might have been the Washington Post? It was a guy who has kind of made it his life's journey to see as many of those eclipses as he can, and he's seen an eclipse on every continent.
Wow, that's pretty neat.
That's.
But the shock and awe factor. He loves the shock and awe factor. Is there an awe factor?
I think there is. For me, that awe factor. I mean, just seeing the solar eclipse is amazing. The awe factor to me was to see that Terminator zone coming at you. I mean, it is just moving. You get to see how fast it moves.
Yeah.
And it was one thing I didn't expect, which is why it was so awesome to me.
I would love to be in the open plains. I think when was the last one we had here in Wisconsin that we could see?
Oh boy, I don't.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
that's a good question.
It's been a while. It's been a heck of a long time.
Yeah,
a partial, not too.
Well, yeah, we've had a few partials.
We had 80+% in August of, was it 2019?
Yeah, right. Yeah, just before the COVID.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool, too. I mean, if you look at what I really liked in those situations is you look at the shadow of trees.
Yeah, me too.
Sort of see it in the shadows.
It's not boring.
Right,
yeah,
it's not boring.
It is not boring. It's very obvious, and you think, wow, that's so cool.
Cool, right. Yeah.
We are talking with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from the... both have originally and currently with the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and they will answer your questions. Roger and Grantsburg, we'll get to you in a couple of minutes right after we take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us. And there's a line open for you, the number to call, 800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to ideas@WPR.org. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news. Stay with us. It's a weather and climate update for you for the next 25 minutes or so here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Steve Ackerman, the former chair, former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin is professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So what do you want to know about maybe how meteorologists forecast visibility? Are you wondering how hot this summer is going to be? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. And let's go to Roger in Grantsburg. Roger, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
You should come up to Grantsburg. It's snowing. The snowflakes are the size of Chrysler's. It was just coming down here a few minutes ago. It was like, oh, my God, they're like half dollars.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
That's like 50 to 100 of them stuck together.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you can make snowballs out of anything out here. We've got about, I don't know, it must have been a... probably about eight inches now, but it melted down, you know. It melted down about six or so. But my question is, I live out here in a heart of flyover land. I mean, there's nothing here around me, wide open. The contrails from airplanes. I do a lot in the field out here working. I see contrails from planes going over here constantly, probably 50, 75 planes a day, you know, maybe 100. And the contrails always seem to form into cloud banks after a while. Is there anything with the contrails that changes our the cloud patterns and weather patterns? And is there anything that they seem to enhance it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. That's a really good question, and there was a NASA experiment that I was actually part of in 1996 to look at this issue, so that when contrails form, they are a combination of condensation trails coming out of the back of the jets, and it's the hot, moist air coming out of the jet that forms these clouds to form. And sometimes they dissipate. Mostly they dissipate. But there are times, if the atmospheric conditions are just right, that they could spread out into a thin cirrus shield. But the atmospheric conditions have to be just right. And by that, I mean the humidity and the temperature in order for those contrails to generally spread.
So do they have effect on the weather?
I wouldn't call it effect on the weather in the sense that when they dissipate, they're clearly not.
Yeah.
If they spread into a contrail, then they can reduce the incoming solar radiation that might be reaching the surface. So it would be a, you know, a thin cirrus kind of day, but that's not really going to lead to any kind of precipitation or anything.
And but that would be a cooling effect too.
It would be a cooling effect,
right? And then at night, the cirrus clouds have warm a little bit. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So they can switch off a little bit.
Yeah. But then if they're going to do that, they got to stay around a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the cloud fraction that these things represent, I imagine, is really small compared to all
You know, the conditions of the atmosphere are already primed to have a thin cirrus. They're just looking for something to kick it off.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
So there you go, Roger. And I advise you to go outside and stick out your tongue and capture some of those big snowflakes that are coming down.
And keep looking up. I'm guessing you might be in a major flight zone. And that's why you're seeing so many of them.
Yeah.
Thanks, Roger. Dave in Sussex, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Actually, I got two questions. One is, can you predict if next winter will be as mild as this last winter? And the second question is, what does it mean when they say a 50% chance of showers? Is that 50% chance where you're at or over a big area? Or can you help explain that for me, please? Thank you.
Okay.
I'll take the first one and leave John for the second one. You can think about how to explain that because it is kind of tricky. But, yeah, no, I don't think – I think we're pretty confident in saying that this winter is not going to be like this past winter for a couple of reasons. We were in El Nino last year and we're transitioning into a La Nina. But also this past winter was so unusual that I think to match it back-to-back is going to be really not likely.
Yeah, just to follow
Much less than a 50-50 chance.
I would agree 100%. I'll follow up before I go to the second question. I think the frequency at which we are visited by such unusual winters, though, will increase. But it doesn't mean we'll get another one next year. I think I agree with Steve on that. The 50% risk of showers. I believe the Weather Service... when they issue that, and I don't know what happens if it gets kind of transmuted a little bit in its meaning when it goes to a radio station or a TV station, but I know the Weather Service, I think, means that it is a combination of, you know, 50% of the county warning area, which is a relatively small region of the state, wherever you happen to be living where you get that information. They say, yeah, there's a chance, about a 50-50 chance that someplace in this area will get a shower this afternoon, and or... if you have the exact same conditions 10 times, 5 times out of those 10, there's going to be showers in the area. So that's kind of the way that I think that's actually meant to be, that's the information that's meant to be conveyed. Yeah.
Okay, there we go. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the call. Dean in Colorado. Your turn. Hi, Dean. Oh, I think we have Dan. Well, Dean, we'll get to you. We have Dan in Stevens Point. Dan, hi.
Hi. I am an environmentalist, have been for a lot of years, but recently I have shifted from being an environmentalist to being a person so concerned about the change in climate that has been the main focus of my activity. I was wondering what the two of you thought about what we as environmentalists, as people concerned about climate change, what we should do to deal with this massive change in our environment.
Those are really good questions. I think there are a couple of things. One is, deal with it at a personal level. So if you can minimize driving, you know, and emitting gas, burning gas, that's a good thing. Recycling is a good thing. And I think the other thing that's important to do is vote. Make sure that you're getting representatives in there that stand for what you believe in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. We were sort of talking about a related issue off the air. The idea that, you know, as I get older and... I'm the youngest guy in this room, I'll say that right now. But we're all of an age where we just don't want to take any more nonsense from people who deny the obvious. Yeah. When I first got to Wisconsin 30 years ago, I thought that climate was going to be slapping my kids in the face in their professional lives. But it's hitting me as I'm getting near the end of my professional life. This has come on a lot stronger and a lot more robustly than I think any of us thought even 30 years ago. So anyone who denies that now does not belong anywhere near representative government. So I'm just going to echo Steve's comment on that.
And the other thing I would answer is, don't give up. Don't get tired and say, forget about this. I'm going to just staying home and drink beer.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Yeah.
There you go, Dan. Thank you so much for calling. Now let's go to Dean in Colorado. Hi, Dean.
Well, since the time you've called, I've called, and we've gotten another couple inches of snow, so we're really piling it on out here.
Yeah.
And I heard the Rockies is really getting a lot of snow again.
Yeah, right now, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were near and a little above average, and here on the Front Range, we're just west of Denver. We got hit with a big orographic event, or upslope, we call it colloquially, and that's when winds coming in and meeting the mountains and clouds form as moisture tries to climb over the mountains. So we picked up almost 40 inches on that one last week. So we're still digging out. But, you know, all that was, you know, I was kidding with my wife about this because we've had a pretty warm winter, and we were watching the harbor cam at Bayfield up there on Lake Superior in your state, and they were doing a polar bear plunge, but there was hardly any ice. They didn't have to top anything. And it was completely bare, no snow at all. And I had to ask my wife, you know, I wonder how much longer the Groundhog Day is going to be a relevant point.
Yeah.
Well, personally, I don't think the groundhog, the groundhog, you can validate their forecast, and the groundhog is right 40% of the time.
Which is nearly impossible. It's like making a casino go bankrupt. You know, people can do it, as we know, but it's not easy.
I mean, it's a very entertaining, fun festivity and great movie, but as a forecaster, you would almost want to go against what the groundhog.
Yeah,
you'd do better if
you would.
You
would. You flat out would. Yeah, but that's right. There was Lake Superior, I think, had only 2.7% ice coverage all winter long. And the average for the lakes was just around 2%. Lake Superior carries a lot of weight. But absolutely right. Absolutely nothing going on here. And then you guys always get your Thanksgiving and your Easter week snowstorms. So this is right on schedule. So you knew that was coming.
Yeah.
And we do have a changing climate, Dean.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Martin, who is north of Green Bay, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Martin.
Hello. Hello, Larry and weathermen. I just wanted to bring up a point to clarify something. You know, I hear this contrails used a lot, and then some people mix it up with chemical trails, you know, where they're actually seeding clouds. And, of course, there's all sorts of conspiracies about they're putting all sorts of chemicals in the air. Anyways, back to the contrails, which, of course, I know you guys understand this. I just want to state it, though. It's short for condensation trails.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing that comes out of automobile exhaust in the wintertime. You can see it because when it's cold out, or your furnace exhaust. Because anytime you burn a hydrocarbon, which contains hydrogen and carbon, the hydrogen combines with oxygen when it's burnt and produces water. And it's the same thing that's happening when a jet flies up in the air. If it's at a point where it's cold enough, it will condense and make those trails. And that's what they're called, contrails. It's water vapor that's condensing after the combustion of the hydrocarbon that makes the jet move.
Yeah.
I just wanted to state that because it seems like, you know, these things get all mixed up, and, you know, there's just so much crazy ideas about some of the stuff these days that can just be simply explained.
Yeah.
Right on target.
And chemtrails, you know, it's a combination of chemical trails, which, again, are a conspiracy theory. These are not something the government's doing with regard to spraying. In fact, there's a lot of photos during World War II of the bombers generating contrails, and that was a real concern because you can identify where they are.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So it's been around for a long time.
And if you were going to seed clouds, you wouldn't do it from 38,000 feet.
That's right. It's
the worst place you could possibly do it.
Martin, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Elizabeth in Poinette emails, so many weather apps offer 15 days and beyond forecasts. Is there any accuracy beyond a week to 10 days?
That's a very reasonable question. I think there are times when you can get a reasonable complexion of a day, 2 weeks downstream painted, but I don't think you should count on it. I think if you were really keeping score, you might say, hey, there's one, that was a success, and here's another one, and maybe that would total maybe 20-ish% at the high end. But from 5 to 7 days, boy, the percentage goes way up. You're talking about high 80% in terms of doing exactly that, accurately painting the complexion of the day. So it does, it tapers off rapidly after about 7 days. That's true. And that may never change.
And one thing I want to point out about weather, this came up in a web conversation I had with a couple of meteorologists. Those weather apps, which are great, there are many of them. Many of us use them. I use several of them. All that data comes from the National Weather
Service.
That's
right. That's right.
It's not coming from the public. They're taking that data because it's freely available.
Right.
And that's really important, I think, that we don't forget that.
Yeah.
And it's important that we have it.
That we have it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you don't, you're paying for those apps.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Kim sent us an email. She believes there was a total solar eclipse in the late 70s, but there might have been others since 1979, but I moved away from Wisconsin, so she doesn't know. But so 78, 79. Right.
The one that I saw in North Dakota was in 79. Now, I don't remember what the path was.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah. I know it didn't get in New England. That's all I know. I was kind of disappointed. So.
Dave in Sherwood recently saw a graph showing the past 9 months being significantly warmer than not only historical averages, but even compared to recent record averages. As climatologists, are you concerned, as Dave is, about the ecological impacts on our forests and agriculture?
I think. I mean, you think about the global warming that's occurring. I mean, it's regional, and it is impacting our ecosystem. I mean, it was interesting this past month, talking to people who ran family maple syrup tapping. Some of them did it in February, which is...
Actually, even the end of January.
Even the end of
Unbelievable.
January. It's just, that's just amazing.
And then if you've been doing that for years and you take a vacation or you plan to do some other kind of work on the farm in January, you lose those 2 weeks.
Right.
And you're done for the season.
There was a piece in the Washington Post about somebody who was gone on vacation. They were in Florida, and then they got a call saying, hey, the sap is running.
Yeah.
They had this huge operation. They had to immediately race back to Wisconsin.
I'm telling
and
you.
They lost some sap because they just weren't ready at the end of January.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Francis emailed us. They wish one of the things that was suggested that people can do on an individual, personal level to address climate change would be to reduce their meat consumption. Meat production produces a very large amount of greenhouse gases and can be easily reduced through what you put on your plate.
Well, that's a good point, and it goes back to doing personally what's important. Mm-hmm. The thing I'll add to that, as you were saying that, Larry, is there's a lot of studies now looking at methane production, and a lot of that in terms of cattle raising as well.
Somebody else is wondering, how big a relationship do seasons have with each other? In other words, if we have a warmer winter, does that mean our summer is going to be warm too, or spring?
No, there's not a really strong relationship because the atmosphere has very short memory. It doesn't have, it doesn't we're not going to remember even a month from now that the winter was warm in terms of the atmosphere.
Yeah, we'll remember.
We'll remember it, but the atmosphere won't. And so the consequence is it almost doesn't matter back a certain amount of time what happened in the prior weeks or days or months. And so that's generally the way it is. Now, if you live near a large body of water and you have a particularly warm summer, you might well have a slightly warmer than normal fall into the winter because the water's taking a little longer to cool down. And so those kind of things, they happen. On the global or continental scale, probably less. So,
You might find visibility predictions where you get your weather forecast. Why does the National Weather Service monitor visibility, and how do they do it?
They do it now pretty modernized in the sense that they have small instruments that look at they shoot a laser through a small volume of the atmosphere, and then they look at the scattering pattern. How does that laser change? And there's a lot of physics behind that to understand how that pattern changes is directly related to visibility. So that's how they primarily do it. It's obviously important in terms of any kind of travel. If you're traveling in a car or taking off in a plane, that's really going to be an important weather parameter you're going to want to look at. And they do have some, not some automated observations at airports, so they still have some humans making those observations, which I think are pretty tricky.
It is. I think my brother was a weather observer in the Air Force, and he said the way that he was lucky to be down in Tacoma at McCord Air Force Base, and Mount Rainier was right there.
So
you can tell what the cloud heights were. He said the heights were not difficult because you had this beautiful marker that you can quickly develop that skill. But I think for visibility in the horizontal, I think the observers do the same thing. They're at the same spot. Like if they're at Dane County Airport, they know that they can't see a certain set of structures or hills if it's less than a quarter mile and so on. So they use that.
That sort of, and what factors in the environment impact visibility?
Water vapor content in the air. So that's a direct measurement too, the humidity and not only the relative humidity, but the actual water vapor content directly.
Dust storms, dust and smoke, things like that.
And likelihood of fog would be related to all three of them.
And I was thinking, just reminded of this because climate change has come up a few times, your story on hardiness zones.
Yeah, so that was something that in November of this past year, the USDA changed their plant hardiness zones. Just looking at that because I do flower gardening and looking where we are. And we're one of those regions in the U.S. where there's most zones in the U.S. either went to a warmer climate by a half a
zone.
Half a zone. We went, I think, from 5B to 5A or the other way around.
Yeah.
Or they stayed the same. Mm. Nobody went to a colder zone.
Yeah.
They do this every few years. The NOAA does their up their normal temperatures every 10 years. And they did that in 2020, I guess.
Yeah, probably right.
Yeah.
And wasn't there something else about the hardiness? This was the biggest region that had an update of its zone.
Yes.
Over the whole country. It was a huge fraction, 40% or more of the country actually had a warmer zone or a less hardy zone.
And here we are now coming into tornado season, generally starts.
Already past that. It started in February.
Yeah, I know it started in February, but April is going to
big months are coming.
Yeah, they're really on their way.
And that's going to give us a lot to talk about in the coming months.
I'm sure of that.
Guys, thanks so much for being with us today. It's always a pleasure.
We'll do it
again the last Monday of April.
Yeah. All right.
We'll probably have had a tornado or two by that.
Hopefully Hopefully in a forest or a plane.
Right. Or over the ocean or a water spout or something. Yeah.
Right. Not here.
No.
Oh, boy. Steve Ackerman is former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW, also a member of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. He's an emeritus professor there. John Martin, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. They will be back the last Monday in April, and we will do this all over again with them, but probably talking about different things. Tomorrow on the show, Patricia McConnell returns for our pet care show. She'll give us some tips on how to teach your dog recall and what to do if your dog won't stop barking, and I'm sure a whole lot more. So that's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.